like a company. Ready!
The Chronicles of the American Civil War begins now. And here's your host, Bob O'Connor.
Hey, thanks for listening in today. I appreciate it. This is week six. If this were beer, we'd just be finishing off our first six-pack. Our audience continues to grow. Thank you all for that. And for those of you who are new to the program, I will repeat just a few bits of information. We broadcast from the podcast studio of the soon-to-be world-famous Chatter Restaurant, 5247 Wisconsin Avenue Northwest, Washington, D.C., right at the Maryland-D.C. state line, across the street from the Friendship Heights Metro Station. We come to you almost live at a location where you can dine and watch our live podcast as we record if you wish. I have dined here myself, had a fine lunch, Wilbon Chili, and we welcome you to do that same if you're visiting the area. Logistically, the podcast will post on Thursday each and every week. Tell your friends they can listen free to the podcast on iTunes, TuneIn, Stitcher, and Google Play. If you want to contact the program to offer support, ask a question, or suggest a speaker, send an email to chronicles@BobO'ConnorBooks.com. You can follow us on Facebook at the Chronicles of the American Civil War or on Twitter at CHROFAMERICANCW. Today's preview is from my nonfiction book, The United States Colored Troops at Andersonville Prison. My book provides information of the 105 black Union soldiers incarcerated in that prison. As you probably remember from Kevin Fry's podcast on the prison, Andersonville was a bad place to spend your time in 1864. Many of the black prisoners had been captured at the Battle of Alusty in Florida in February 1864. Some even survived their incarceration. One black soldier in that book is of particular interest. His name was Thomas Esten Hemmings, who was an assistant cook for the 175th Ohio Infantry. Do you know the name Hemmings, Mark, from Mount Vernon?
Oh, yeah. I believe connected with Jefferson, right?
Right. Sally Hemmings was a slave to Thomas Jefferson and also Jefferson's wife's half-sister. Thomas Esten Hemmings was Sally Hemmings' grandson.
Wow.
I have studied the black Union prisoners of the American Civil War and have service records of over 2,500 black prisoners of war. If you are interested in this book or the other 11 American Civil War books I have written and published, please visit my website at www.BobO'ConnorBooks.com. You are listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. My name is Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. Today's program features part two of my discussion with C.W. Whitehair, American Civil War author and a good friend. Today he and I will be discussing his book, Gettysburg, The Field of Glory, July 3, 1863, Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, the third and last day of the battle, Pickett's Charge. I cannot even imagine participating in Pickett's Charge. Welcome back, C.W.
Thank you, Bob. It's good to be with you.
Please remind my listeners how and when you got involved in studying the American Civil War.
Well, I lived in Harpers Ferry for about 24 to 30 years, and you cannot live in Harpers Ferry without being interested in John Brown and the Civil War. I actually got started due to my mother, who was a reenactor. Actually, it was where she worked at a place called John Brown and the Civil War Showcase near Harpers Ferry, which today is the Harpers Ferry KOA. I used to go to work with her, and I became interested in reenacting, but at 14 years of age, I was too young to use a weapon, so I learned to play a bugle. I was auditioned, and they gave me a part in a place as a Civil War reenactor. Matter of fact, I was the only bugler. I belonged to an organization called the Blue and Gray Association from Hagerstown, Maryland. There were about 500 members who agreed to do two reenactments every Saturday and two every Sunday at 11, and again at 5 o'clock. Everything was authentic. The only way guns could be brought onto the field was by horses, and the wagons were pulled by mules, unlike today's reenactments. All camps and personnel were to appear authentic. You could be asked to be a Yankee one week and a Rebel the next. There could be no bias. Besides living in Harpers Ferry and as an active reenactor, I also made the acquaintance of an elderly lady who lived operated John Brown's Fort at the Storr College campus, now the Maffer Training Center. She was a graduate of Storr College. At the age of 8 also, I made the acquaintance of an elderly lady who lived behind the town's park. She lived in Harpers Ferry during and after the Civil War. She used to tell me stories about her father, who served in the 2nd Virginia Infantry or the Stonewall Brigade, and her uncle, who rode with Colonel John Mosby, who was known as the Gray Ghost. Later in life, I checked out her information about her family and discovered that she had told me the truth. Whatever happened to her, I don't know, but it just fueled my interest more and more for the Civil War.
Your books always seem to have a link to Harpers Ferry, which makes sense since you grew up there. This book doesn't. Why the change in the locale of your books?
Well, I wanted to do something different. Gettysburg has always been a battle that most people are interested in. I wanted to use a real person, my great-great-great-uncle, who was an eyewitness to the Third Day's fighting. I wanted to use other eyewitness accounts as well. Most of those eyewitness accounts come from the men who served in Brigadier General Robert Garnett's brigade of Major General George Pickett's division. Gettysburg's been written and rewritten to no end, so I wrote something different than other authors. When you read Gettysburg, The Field of Glory, one sees the battle through the eyes of the ordinary soldier in the ranks. The book does not talk about what Lee should have done or Meade did not do. I wanted to capture the hardships of campaigning, in the separation from family and home, in the suffering and tragedy of warfare. We're better to get the information than from those who were participants and eyewitnesses.
I'd have to agree with that. Tell us a little bit about your narrator, Jonathan Russell.
Jonathan Russell is my great-great-great uncle from my mother's side of the family. Jonathan was from Loudoun County, Virginia. He came from a family of 6 girls and 6 boys. All of them had biblical names. He was actually the youngest of the 12 children. Prior to the war, he was a farmer, just an ordinary person. His father owned 135 acres of property at the eastern slope, or I should say at the base of the eastern slope of Loudoun Heights, which overlooks the Shenandoah River and Harpers Ferry. When Civil War commenced, he enlisted to serve with the Confederacy. Coming from an area that was mostly loyal to the Union cause, but he held to his convictions because of what we would call today states' rights. Jonathan was born on May the 9th, 1824, so he was well long into his 30s when he served in the 8th Virginia Infantry with his half-brother, James, who was from a previous marriage. Jonathan lived through the war and returned to farming once more in Loudoun County, and the year that he died and where he is buried, I'm not for sure. He could be buried where some of the Russell family is buried, in an old cemetery near Harpers Ferry, which actually has no head markers today. But his brother, James, is buried between two Union soldiers at Union Cemetery in Waterford, Virginia.
As you and I know well, and we have had this discussion many times before, people think authors who write fiction make everything up. Tell our listeners just how much research you need to do to write a book like this and what your sources were.
Well, everything is not made up. There is a lot of nonfiction material written into my book as well as any historical fiction book. I chose to write the book in first person because I wanted to draw the reader into a personal relationship with the narrator. Many can identify with someone like this rather than have it presented in another fashion. My mother-in-law is a good example of this because she would rather learn her history through historical fiction than just reading regular history. It keeps her interest, so it keeps, I'm sure, a lot of other people their interest also. I had one gentleman who read the book not once, but he actually read it three times because he enjoyed the way that the history was presented. As for sources, they vary. For this book, I used the official records of the Union and Confederate armies, the Southern Historical Society papers, Waterford Historical Foundation records, their archives, regimental histories, especially those who served under General Garnett and his brigade. And there was one diary that I wanted to use, and I did use, but I had a very difficult time in locating it, and I had to use the assistance of a friend who lived in Harpers Ferry to help me. I used other soldiers' diaries. I used my own family history. Whenever I write anything, I always use more than one source. I like to compare them. Like a detective, with any book that I write, I attempt to answer questions, especially my own. I want to make sure the history is as correct as I can make it and piece together any lapse in time. I once had a history professor from Princeton University who I met at Harpers Ferry tell me to make sure whatever you're writing that all your I's are dotted and all your T's are crossed, because there's always going to be someone who is going to read it and they're going to scrutinize it. Well, I took it all to heart. I'm the type of person that once I'm convinced that I have dug up as much information that I can discover, I continue on to the next event. Authors who write historical fiction use as much in the way of real resources as they can possibly locate.
Give us an idea of what happened at Pickett's Charge, according to your narrator.
Most of the soldiers in the Army of Northern Virginia believed that one more great battle and the war would end. Their confidence was very high. They believed that they could defeat the Union Army on any battlefield on any given day. They had defeated the Union Army at Fredericksburg in December of 1862, and again at Chancellorsville in May of 1863. Their morale was high, and like their general, believed they were unbeatable. Besides, the book covers some of Jonathan's life prior to the war and events leading up to the third day's fighting at Gettysburg, such as the fight at Winchester, Virginia. It covers the fight in great detail. While marching to Hagerstown, Maryland, and up into Pennsylvania, I used many detailed descriptions from soldiers' letters and diaries, especially those written by Jonathan's brother, James. I found one story interesting that a soldier from the 56th Virginia Infantry of Garnett's brigade had substituted on occasions for others. Substitutes are generally individuals who took the place of another person who was drafted, and they would do this for a fee. After collecting the bounty, they served in their place. Anyway, a soldier from the 56th Virginia was caught, court-martialed, and sentenced to die by firing squad. The execution took place near Hagerstown, Maryland. The event left a memorable impression on the men at Garnett's brigade who witnessed the event. The mood of the soldiers while approaching the battlefield was very somber. Before their part in the battle, they attempted to write letters, while others joked around. But most of the soldiers got rid of their playing cards or poker cards and turned to reading their Bibles. One soldier wrote as he looked across the field that, quote, "We all knew the gravity of the situation and the astonishing work before us. Every man was willing to make the charge. Every man was willing to make the fight. Every man was willing to do his duty for his country. We did not need a commanding officer to tell us what to do. We only needed to know what was to be expected of us." General Garnett on that day had 1,287 officers and men in his brigade. One soldier overheard General Pickett say to General Garnett before they crossed the field, quote, "I want you to get your men over that field as soon as possible. I believe that you are going to catch hell over there. It is a devilish ugly place over there, and we can't afford for them to double teams on us," unquote. Once Pickett and Garnett were finished speaking, a soldier led the men in a hymn, and then a chaplain led the men in a word of prayer. One soldier said, or later wrote, quote, "This is what this fight has come down to, prayer and valor," unquote. Garnett marched his men across the field. As the Federal artillery tore great gaps in the Confederate line, they closed up their ranks, filling those gaps by dressing their ranks to the left. Once Garnett's brigade made a left oblique, the Federal artillery had the ability to sweep their ranks. When they tried to go over the high fence that bordered the Emmitsburg Road, the eyewitness accounts are horrifying. One soldier wrote that the men were falling backward and forward into the road. He wrote, quote, "Men were dropping from the fences as if swept by a giant sickle swung by some powerful force of nature," unquote. From the Emmitsburg Road to the Stonewall Fence where the Federal soldiers were firing away, the charge was just like a mob. Once about 300 Confederates made it over the Stonewall Fence, there are some very vivid accounts of the savagery and the conflict that took place. One Confederate soldier recalled, quote, "Men came so close to each other that they fired their weapons not more than 5 feet apart. Flames scorched their clothing, causing their uniform coats to catch fire. Some soldiers threw down their muskets and fought fist to fist, while others used their muskets as clubs. Human life was cheap, and the wrath and fury of war was being satisfied with the shedding of blood," unquote.
Oh, my goodness. I can't even imagine.
I can't either.
Did Jonathan Russell make it over the Stonewall?
No. After the Union forces holding the Stonewall moved back towards a grove of trees, he, with others, continued to fire from the wall, Stonewall fence. He only recognized six men from the 8th Virginia Infantry, really believing that his regiment had been totally destroyed. While at the Stonewall Fence, he looked and he heard General Armistead, whose brigade had come up by now, say to Lieutenant Colonel Raleigh Martin that they could not stay at the wall, that, quote, "they must go over," unquote. Martin, who commanded the 53rd Virginia Infantry of Armistead's brigade, began to lead about 300 men through an opening in the Stonewall Fence, but he was wounded. At this point, Armistead led them. shouting, boys give them, shouting, quote, boys give them the cold steel, unquote. And then shortly thereafter, he was wounded and he died several days later. Jonathan's brother, James, was captured and served time at Point Lookout, Maryland, before being exchanged. But Jonathan, he came through the battle actually uninjured.
What regiments were involved in Pickett's charge?
Those regiments were the 8th Virginia, the 18th Virginia, the 19th Virginia, the 28th Virginia, and the 56th Virginia Infantry Regiments. They served under Brigadier General Richard Garnett, and they were the 2nd Brigade of Major General George Pickett's division. Now, a little word about Garnett. Garnett had actually commanded the 1st Virginia Brigade, or as we know them, the Stonewall Brigade, at the Battle of Kernstown in March of 1862 while serving in Stonewall Jackson's Small Valley Army. But he got himself into a lot of trouble for failing to obey Stonewall's orders. Of course, nothing came of the event, but after Jackson pursued charges against Garnett, but Lee knew that Garnett was too good of an officer not to lead a command. But somewhere the accusations always bothered Garnett that Jackson had made against him.
What other divisions were involved in Pickett's charge?
George Pickett's division actually was to the south, marching across the field. Johnston Pettigrew's division was to the north, beside of Pickett's division, and then Isaac Trimble's division was actually following Pettigrew's division. Pickett's division, part of the way across the field, they had to carry out a left oblique, which is where a maneuver, which is where every man had to make a 45-degree left turn movement. They had to perform this maneuver so that they came into perfect alignment with General Pettigrew's division while approaching a high-stake and rider fence that bordered the Emmitsburg Road.
I heard a lady speak at Antietam Battlefield years ago, remembering that her great-grandfather told her that the ground shook every minute of the entire day at Sharpsburg as he had been there. I can imagine it was not much different at Gettysburg on that Pickett's charge.
In fact, Jonathan Russell, he said, quote, the ground shook after the first barrage as if we were in the throes of an earthquake. Now, they were hardcore veterans who were used to battle, but that day men's nerves were being tested. Tensions were high. They were not used to this kind of situation. Not everyone stayed in their places. Some of the men of the 8th became restless and were actually willing to defy danger. Richard Mattox of C Company of the 8th Virginia Infantry was one of those persons. He took his comrades' canteens to a nearby house behind a ridge to fill them with water. When he returned about 15 minutes later, he had discarded his cap for a straw hat. Another witness seen General Lee and a staff officer ride between the artillery guns and the men. It both horrified and thrilled the men to see Lee place himself in this kind of danger. There were eyewitness accounts of officers walking along the lines and speaking words of encouragement to their men. There was an incident where Russell felt this wet mist spray the side of his uniform, only to look up and see that a Union artillery shell had exploded and killed several of his comrades, Privates Morse and Jackson of his company. It was actually their blood and body parts that had been splattered over the side of his uniform. When there was a lull in the artillery action, General James Longstreet rode slowly out along the artillery line. Many of the men believed that Longstreet was going to lead the charge and began to shout for him, quote, to get back, we'll go without you, unquote. Longstreet acknowledged his men and rode back into the wooded area only to shortly have General Pickett to emerge and call the men to arms. When I took part in the 145th Gettysburg reenactment, there were 100 Confederate artillery pieces on the field for Pickett's charge. I was on the artillery line covering the cannonade for a Civil War publication. When the guns fired, the ground shook. They kept it up for a good 20 minutes or longer. It was the closest that I've ever come to experiencing the real thing. I heard that people as far away as in Frederick, Maryland, in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, could hear the guns during the prelude to Pickett's charge.
I've talked to reenactors who walked the field during the filming of the movie Gettysburg. They said they cried all the way across the field at Pickett's charge because it was so emotional for them. How authentic do you think those scenes in the movie were?
Well, those scenes from the movie, I would say, were very authentic. It's a movie that I've watched numerous times.
Me
the
too.
Movie could have never been made possible without the help and expertise of Civil War reenactors. Every serious reenactor is trained by the book according to which branch of service that they are portraying. No one fires a musket until they learn the 9 steps to doing so. No one fires a cannon until they learn all the do's and don'ts and safety rules. No one rides a horse with a saber in his hand until he learns how to use it and to engage his opponent safely. Reenactors learn how to form a battle line, cavalry columns, a medical unit. It is all by the book according to the times. When a movie like Gettysburg, where thousands upon thousands of reenactors are on the field, one gets caught up emotionally as well as a considerable amount of adrenaline is flowing while portraying such an event. I'm sure it was a trying time for them. Whenever you act out something and try to make it authentic and think of what it was like, you do have an ability to become emotional. I've actually attended Civil War funerals or memorials, and I know sometimes reenactors become very emotional. They cry. I know from my own experiences as a reenactor, you make the best attempt to do everything as authentic as possible and to portray what it was like, what the soldiers went through, as well as what the civilians went through.
Absolutely. It is a miracle anyone survived that day. Statistically, how many men started across that field, and what were the number and percentage of Confederate casualties at Pickett's charge?
All total, in Pickett's charge, there were somewhere between 12,000 to 15,000 men. Out of the 3 divisions that crossed the field, there was a casualty rate of 50%. George Pickett had a little over 5,000 men in his division. But at roll call on Saturday morning, July the 4th, after the third day's fighting, only about 1,600 men could answer the call to duty, and they were actually given charge of the 4,000 Union soldiers who had been captured at Gettysburg. And General Garnett's brigade, which the 8th Virginia belonged to, there were 1,287 officers and men who answered the call to duty on the morning of July the 3rd. 960 of them became casualties of war.
Oh, my goodness.
Every line officer was killed, wounded, or captured. On Friday morning, July the 3rd, the 8th Virginia Infantry mustered 212 men, but only 34 of those 212 men could answer the call to duty that evening. Generals Armistead and Garnett were mortally wounded and killed, and General Kemper was seriously wounded. As one Confederate soldier later wrote, many years later wrote, quote, "Again, Virginia bleeds at every pore. When the long black list of casualties reaches home, there will not be a fireside that is not without mourning," unquote. It was a very, very tragic end to a very hard-fought battle.
Well, I guess we need to switch to a little lighter note, because those were certainly chilling words and an extraordinary amount of casualties. In your book, you wrote about Jonathan's eating a corn dogger. That's not an expression I'm familiar with. What exactly is a corn dogger?
Well, corn doggers were generally cornmeal with a little water added in, and actually they made a paste from it. And a soldier would place his corn doggers in a skillet, a hot skillet of bacon grease, and fry them up until they were good and crunchy. He actually had some corn doggers on that afternoon before they actually took part in Pickett's charge. Pickett actually had his men on Seminary Ridge, and not only were they eating corn doggers, but of course they were also eating bacon and hardtack, which unfortunately would be the last meal for some of them. Other soldiers, they weren't eating anything. One soldier actually wrote that everything was in a, quote, lazy and dull mood, unquote.
I'm surprised that corn doggers have not made it into today's fast food menus. Go ahead.
Actually, my wife, my wife's mother, Ellen, she knows all about corn doggers. When I mentioned to her, and when she read this in the book, she knew exactly what corn doggers were. She's had corn doggers before.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Before we wrap up, I think my listeners might be interested in your little dog and its famous name.
Well, he is a 6-pound latte poodle. He weighs 6 pounds. Well, anyway, when we got him, I wanted to name him. I wanted to name him after my grandfather, Stanley. And my wife, Rhonda, said no. She said, you name the last dog. And I said, okay. I says, what are you going to call him? And she says, I'm going to call him Mosby. And I said, Mosby? I said, after John Mosby, the great ghost? And she says, yes, I will call him Mosby, and I will call him Colonel Mosby. And whenever he hears that name, he perks up. You know, he'll come right to you, even if he just hears Colonel. But anyway, she had this lady make a gray hat with a black plume in it. And Rhonda's mother, who is a very skilled seamstress, made him a little vest with a Bonnie Blue on it. So at times we would take him with us to reenactments and we would dress him up. And sometimes, you know, if she wants to send a photograph of him to somebody, she'll take and she'll dress him up. And he's very good at posing. He's not shy of the camera. He probably should have been in TV.
Well, he also has a little hat with a feather, which Mosby would have worn.
Yeah, a black plume.
Please tell my listeners the topics of your other Civil War books.
I sure can. My other books are Escape Across the Potomac, which is about the escape of 1,500 Union cavalrymen during the siege at Harper's Ferry during the 1862 Maryland campaign. Libby Life is a book. It's actually the diary of Lieutenant Colonel Federico Fernandez Cavada. Cavada was actually the highest-ranking Hispanic officer to serve in the United States Army during the Civil War. Cavada was captured at Gettysburg during the second day's fight and spent 9 months at Libby Prison in Richmond, Virginia. The next book is Mosby, The War Years, which chronicles the life of Colonel John Singleton Mosby, or as he is known, the Grey Ghost, prior to and during the Civil War.
That's not about Mosby, not about your dog?
No, not about the dog. Mosby commanded the 43rd Battalion Virginia Cavalry. Mosby's raids were actually carried out with surprise, shock, and speed against the federal forces. Although he had no formal military training, he was a brilliant tactician. Belle Boyd, the rebel spy, chronicles the life of Belle Boyd, the famous rebel spy who operated in the lower Shenandoah Valley during the Civil War. Belle was very educated, intelligent, aggressive, deceptive, and knew how to use a woman's beauty and a woman's wiles to accomplish her purposes. Also, I should mention 30% of the book covers her life after the war as an author and as an actress, and there's not been a book that's been published before that has this amount of information on her life after the war. My book in, on her is actually the first nonfiction biography that has been published on her life in the past 34 years. The Struggle for Harpeth Ferry is an overview of Harpeth Ferry prior to and during the Civil War. It covers the town's early history, John Brown's raid, the Civil War, and the beginning of the first African-American school of learning, which is very interesting. Now, my novels are The Bloody Harvest, which is a story about how the Union spy network works as opposed to the Confederate spy network. Actually, the characters, they reveal the history. They both represent the North and the South in it. And what is good about this book is it takes place in Fairfax County, Virginia, in Richmond, Virginia. And it concludes during the Battle of Antietam in Sharpsburg, Maryland. Northern Fire was actually my second book that I wrote, and it actually takes place after the Civil War. We took a family from the North and a family from the South, and we put them in a number of scenarios and challenges to bring about reconciliation. Many believe with the stacking of arms at Appomattox that the war concluded and the strife was going to end, but that's not so. That's far from the truth. So we wanted to do something different with this book. And Fire Along the River, that's a novel that deals with life in Harpeth Ferry prior to and during the Civil War. When one reads the book, they do not only read about the military aspects of the war that affected the area, but also how it affected civilians. Some of the chapters in the book, they take place in Frederick, in Sharpsburg, Maryland. They take place in Manassas and Winchester, Virginia.
Our time is almost up. Please take this opportunity to tell my listeners how they may purchase one or many of your fine books.
Okay, my books can be purchased at Amazon.com, at BarnesandNoble.com, and at InfinityPublishing.com. And, of course, there's other online retailers that cover these books. And some of these books can be found also at Harpeth Ferry and other bookstores.
Thanks for being my guest. Here's hoping you and Rhonda have a great day.
And I do thank you, Bob.
Appreciate it. You are listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is Bob O'Connor. We'll be right back. Listening to C.W. Whitehair's talk about Pickett's charge at Gettysburg has made me think about my family's trip to Gettysburg in 1952. Remember that year, Mark?
not that well.
I was 7 years old. I remember vividly, it was my first trip to Gettysburg and seeing the Eternal Light Peace Memorial and climbing around the rocks at Devil's Den while shooting at my big brother with my imaginary musket. I still remember an old, worn, and torn cyclorama painting, a disappointing sight for that little boy. That was so far back in the day that those little stone buildings at the park entrance had uniformed guides willing to jump in your car and give you a battlefield tour. Gettysburg National Battlefield is still one of my most favorite Civil War sites, and that worn, torn, and spotted cyclorama painting has been miraculously restored and is worth the trip to Gettysburg just to see the cyclorama painting. Civil War events coming up this weekend include a reenactment at Kearney Park in Fresno, California, a living history demonstration at Chickamauga National Military Park in Georgia, and a battlefield hike at Monocacy National Battlefield in Frederick, Maryland. Today's little-known fact about the American Civil War is 445 American Civil War generals graduated from West Point, the United States Military Academy, 294 Union generals, and 151 Confederate generals all attended West Point. In 60 major battles, the commanding general for both armies were West Point graduates. General Robert E. Lee also served as the commandant at West Point. Today in American Civil War history, October 19, 1864, the Battle of Cedar Creek near Stroudsburg, Virginia, began in the Shenandoah Valley. Confederate forces, commanded by General Jubal Early, fought against Union troops led by General Philip Sheridan. Some historians believe that the stunning Union victory at Cedar Creek led directly to the re-election of Abraham Lincoln. Today's special segment on words or expressions from the American Civil War examines the word hookers. Mark, you probably won't believe this, but ladies of the night followed both armies during the war.
Mm-hmm.
Those who trailed General Hooker's Union Army were known as Hooker's Girls, and then by the shortened name of just Hookers.
Wow, okay.
How about that?
It's good to know where that comes from.
Today's quotation from the American Civil War comes from Confederate General Jubal Early, who said, "The Army of Northern Virginia was never defeated. It merely wore itself out, whipping the enemy." Tune in next week as my special guest is Dr. Edward Steers, Jr., one of the country's leading experts on the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. To contact us, please send an email to chronicles@BobO'ConnorBooks.com. Here are some of my recent emails. And I quote, "Ted Alexander's program on Antietam Battlefield was so interesting that I have pushed a visit to Sharpsburg, Maryland, up to a priority spot on my bucket list." That's signed Samuel Johnston, Flagstaff, Arizona. From Ralph Burton in Collinswood, New Jersey. And I quote, "I have just discovered your podcast based on a recommendation from a friend. I am very impressed by the subject, the guest, and the content. Thanks." And a third email that says, and I quote, "I am disappointed that I have not heard the leaf blower on your show. What do you know that Mr. Tony does not know?" That's signed Fred from Washington, D.C.
Well, you might have heard it last week if you're listening closely.
His reference was to the Tony Kornheiser podcast that is recorded much earlier in the morning, when the leaf blower likes to crank up his noisy machine and make his presence known. The leaf blower, Mark, actually sent me a Twitter message telling me our program was too intellectual for him to bother.
Well, you know.
Whatever. Thanks again to Chatter, my expert producer Mark Stern, and today's guest C.W. Whitehair. Thanks to all of you who have been listening. Tell your friends about the program and ask them to check us out online. We will be right here at the same time and same podcast location next Thursday. You've been listening to the Chronicles of the American Civil War. This is Bob O'Connor. Gleams where the flowers have been.